Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
When I was invited to speak here on Catholic feminism, I experienced something of a mental whiplash. I have been studying and thinking and writing and speaking on this theme in one way or another for more than 20 years. But the context in the world, but also in the church too, has shifted markedly over these two decades. So before getting into the meat of my talk, I want to share a bit of my own story, the inspiration for my work in this area, some signs of hope, and some strange new currents. So as one who was baptized Catholic as an infant, but then remained virtually uncatechized in a family rent by three divorces, I experienced a profound reversion while a student at the very liberal New England or Vermont school, Middlebury College. So I was a progressive pro-choice feminist early in college, and I volunteered for my then Congressman, Bernie Sanders. I took several women's studies courses and helped lead my college's women's center, all while attending AA meetings, which I'd entered as a 17-year-old, and eventually ended up studying political philosophy. So by the time I graduated, I had prayed, wept, and read myself back into the church, which, and it's obviously a very long story, its own talk. So the sexual revolution of the 1970s, which had propelled the massive uptick in divorces of my own parents' generation and really informed the backdrop of my own reckless teenage behavior too, had left its deep wounds, as did the suicides of two close male friends, one when I was in high school and another when I was in college. For the sacramental graces I received upon coming back into the church were and really still are transformative healing bombs for which I remain deeply, deeply grateful each and every day. Pope St. John Paul II's theology of the body and his beautiful teachings on the dignity and vocation of women were first introduced to me as a graduate student in theology. They had been developed in the prior decade or two before my own conversion, and by that time were the subject of intense interest and study and scrutiny. John Paul II's thought was a true revelation to me. I had blithely assumed early on in college, as most feminists do, that Catholicism was virulently anti-Catholic. Now, by this time, when I was studying him, my heart had started to soften, and I was eager to learn. But in reading JP2, I found my feminist concerns better answered by the Catholic Pope than anything I had read in my women's studies classes. And so over these last 20 years, I have felt called to carry out, to the best of my limited abilities, kind of marching orders from that saintly and learned Pope. As he wrote in 1995 in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae on human life, quote, "In transforming culture so that it supports life, women occupy a place in thought and action which is unique and decisive. It depends on them to promote a new feminism, which rejects the temptation of imitating models of male domination in order to acknowledge and affirm the true genius of women in every aspect of the life of society, and to overcome all discrimination, violence, and exploitation," end quote. So you can say that I'm a JP2 new feminist through and through. And in that, I don't think I've changed much at all, even as my faith and love of Christ and his church has deepened over this time. But the times have changed, and so have parts of the American church. So my first two books, The Cost of Choice, Women Evaluate the Impact of Abortion in 2004, and Women, Sex, and the Church, A Case for Catholic Teaching in 2010, were collections of essays I edited in my free time when I was a young mother at home with 2 and then 5 children, respectively. In those volumes, my female co-authors and I sought to persuade, to offer sweet, pro-woman reasons for defending the sanctity of human life in the first, and then in the second, Catholic teachings on sex and marriage. In those early books, and then later, as my children grew older, in my own legal scholarship, I sought to marshal arguments and evidence for how the abortion-backed contraceptive revolution, the sexual revolution, had failed women, and especially poor women. I sought to show the ways in which modern feminism's privileging of abortion rights as a means toward equality and freedom and even women's health did indeed imitate models of male domination in its quest for individual autonomy at all costs. Indeed, by the time I had come back to the church in college, I had already changed my own mind about abortion, but not because I had stopped being a feminist. Rather, I had quietly begun to change my mind because I was a feminist. If abortion was required for women to be free to act in the world as equals of men, as so much pro-abortion rights argument maintains, as we're hearing so much of today, wouldn't that mean that being female, with our body's capacity for childbearing, the definitional difference from being male, wouldn't that mean that being female made women inherently unequal? But isn't that what scores of kind of misogynist writers throughout history had always said about women? And if sex burdens women unequally, as radical feminists were particularly and are particularly attuned to, why would they then demand easy abortion for women, rather than seek something more from men, from society, from ourselves? Abortion, it seemed to me, when I got around to thinking about what it really was, exerted that same sort of oppressive might makes right domination over its small human victim that female victims had experienced since the dawn of time at the hands of vicious, dominating men. Feminists rightly objected to unjust legal norms that seemed to ratify men's superior strength as a weapon used to subordinate physically weaker women, who were made more vulnerable still when pregnant. But if I truly wanted justice for the vulnerable and disenfranchised, which I wholeheartedly did as a college student, I couldn't countenance violent injustice against the weakest members of the human family, to whom I began to see that we all owed duties of care. Further, I came to discover from my own recovery in AA a truth of the great natural law tradition, and it was this: acts of injustice harm the unjust actor as much as the victim, even when injustice put her in a terrible position in the first place. Abortion wasn't only harming women's mental and physical health, it was burdening their very souls. But what I would come to learn in time from organizations like Feminists for Life and my own study is that generations of feminists before modern feminism's hegemonic rule had believed those very same things. In our deeply divisive culture war politics today, the fault lines are often drawn around how one thinks about the intersecting feminist and sexual revolutions of the 1970s, revolutions that reshaped Western society in really fundamental ways, transforming how most of us live, love, and work today. Those in favor of this kind of package deal tend to line up on the left, and those opposed on the right. But what is assumed by both left, increasingly we're told women, and right, increasingly men, is that the sexual revolution and feminism necessarily go hand in hand. In a striking example of the horseshoe theory, anti-feminists and their progressive feminist adversaries both assume that to embrace feminism is necessarily to embrace abortion rights and the sexual revolution too. But as John Paul II articulated, Catholic teaching illuminates, and early feminist history details, the truth is quite different than our modern politics seem to allow. Here was a Catholic pope, at the end of the 20th century, denouncing, as Vatican II had as well, discrimination, violence, and exploitation of women, just as feminists always had, even as he beautifully defended Christianity's perennial teachings on sex and marriage. To him, the sex revolution and feminism, rightly understood, were not a package deal, but were rather in deep tension with one another. But it was only when I dug very deeply into the primary source material for my recent book, The Rights of Women, that I began to see that the 18th and 19th century women's rights advocates, those we now call early or first wave feminists, those I'd first heard about through Feminists for Life so long ago, were not just opposed to abortion because everyone else at that time was in the late 18th and mid-19th century. This kind of claim is what both pro-choice legal scholars, who I'm often in sort of dialogue with, and anti-feminists tend to assume. As I was working to understand this early movement's theory of rights, to ascertain just how it differed from modern abortion rights theory, which I'd by then spent a good deal of time writing about, I discovered just how revelatory the first wave's anti-abortion views were in explaining how they thought about their rights and much else. You see, these early feminists and our country's first female physicians, and they were all actually, the physicians were getting their medical licenses, and these early advocates were starting to make arguments in exactly sort of the antebellum period, so 1850s. They all condemned abortion, and I'm going to quote variously from some of them, as child murder, the highest crime in the calendar, the crying sin of the age, and a degradation of the medical profession. To them, and you don't hear, by the way, that Elizabeth Blackwell, the first female physician, was one of those quotes. We never hear about that, right? To them, every human being, whether man, woman, or child, was equally worthy of concern, care, and respect simply by virtue of being human. Indeed, the very same arguments they made for women's equal dignity assumed the equal moral status of the unborn human being, too. All human beings are equal in worth, whatever their differences and vulnerabilities. Or they aren't. And that, my friends, is a Christian argument. Because as it turns out, these early feminists were, with some exceptions, Bible-believing Christians. Not only that, but as we'll see, their rights claims for co-equal education, for property and contract rights, for what they called voluntary motherhood, or the right to engage voluntarily in that act that might make them a mother, that is, sex, were Christian claims too. That is, they saw rights as inextricably bound up with responsibilities, just as the Catholic natural law tradition does. The last one, voluntary motherhood, was synonymous with another word some used, chastity. Indeed, these women were seeking to elevate women just as Christianity had, denouncing the sexual double standard, a standard that made women solely responsible for sexual misadventures that pagan society gladly accepted in men. Indeed, Mary Wollstonecraft, in her influential 1792 treatise, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, identifies the want of chastity in men as the single most consequential offense against women. Her own vision of sexual integrity for both sexes, with a view toward virtuous relationships of mutual trust and collaboration, poses an especially striking challenge to the package deal of modern feminism. That's the lost vision I articulate at great length in my book, The Rights of Women, Reclaiming a Lost Vision. Wollstonecraft writes, quote, "The little respect paid to chastity in the male world is, I am persuaded, the grand source of many of the physical and moral evils that torment mankind, as well as the vices and follies that degrade and destroy women." She goes on, "Chastity, modesty, public spirit, and all the noble train of virtues on which social virtue and happiness are built should be understood and cultivated by all mankind, that is, by both men and women. Or," she continues, "they will be cultivated to little effect." 50 years later, influential abolitionist and women's rights advocate Sarah Grimke defended the early American women's movement against slanderous accusations that it was one and the same with those who were promoting kind of free love, sort of a fringe movement at that time. In her 1850 essay, Marriage, she writes, quote, "The doctrine that human beings are to follow their attractions, which lies at the base of that miscalled free love system, is fraught with infinite danger. We are too low down to listen for one moment to its siren voice," she goes on. "Let me then exculpate the women's rights movement from the charge of tending directly and rapidly to the free love system and nullifying the very idea of marriage as anything more than a partnership of will." That was the charge they were making. "On the contrary, our great desire," she writes, "is to purify and exalt the marriage relation and destroy all licentiousness or lustfulness. In marriage," she says, "is the origin of life." And then connecting the early movement's views of abortion and chastity, Sarah Norton, who worked for women's entry into Cornell, spoke for the movement as a whole when she wrote that they longed for a time when, quote, "the unchastity in men will be placed on an equality with the unchastity of women, and when the rights of the unborn will not be denied or interfered with." So as I will demonstrate tonight, in their defense of vulnerable human life, chaste marriage, women's education, and other civil rights, these early feminists appealed to the Imago Dei in Genesis, just as John Paul II would more than 100 years later in his Mulieris Dignitatum on the dignity and vocation of women. So yes, what I'm saying is that feminism at its origins was Christian. Now, I'm not suggesting that the learned Pope read these remarkable female thinkers who I will share with you tonight. I only know for sure that he read fellow philosopher St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, or Edith Stein. But these early female thinkers, from as far back as Christine de Pizan in the early 15th century, Mary Estelle in the 17th, Wollstonecraft in the late 18th, Sarah Grimke, Lucretia Mott, and the antebellum women's movement in the mid-19th century, to Edith Stein in the early 20th. These female thinkers articulated strikingly similar arguments to one another and to JP too, even as their religious backgrounds and their politics differed. Will I go so far as to claim that early feminism was faithfully Catholic? With the exception of Pizan, no, I will not. Most of the women I'll refer to tonight were 18th and 19th century English and American Protestants who had little knowledge of or use for the high ecclesiology or apostolic claims of we papists. But, and this is a crucial point, these women were responding to the very same cultural and economic shifts to which the church was responding at the same time, namely liberalism and industrial capitalism, as well as that perennial threat to women, which I've already mentioned, of course, the failure of men to live chastity and to carry out their responsibilities as fathers. And so even if these women weren't privileged to receive the graces of the sacraments as I do, as many of you do, these women read their Bibles and understood them and the God who inspired them to deeply inform their work. So then, John Paul II was not courting scandal when he called himself the first feminist pope to a room full of Catholic female scholars. Not because he changed perennial teachings, no, not at all, popes can't do that, but because he took up the challenge posed by feminism, just as popes and councils in every era have courageously taken up the challenges that have captivated their own eras. And he tested feminism, separating the wheat from the chaff. And in doing so, he called what was true in feminist arguments true, and he called what was false, false. And there he thereby deepened our understanding of perennial Christian teachings that from the moment they broke into a misogynist pagan cultures, edified women and children and ennobled sex and marriage. In sifting through feminist claims, he followed St. Augustine's wise counsel. Quote, "Let every good and true Christian understand that wherever truth may be found, it belongs to the master. And while he recognizes and acknowledges the truth, let him reject the figments of superstition. And so he began himself, John Paul II, began himself to envision, building upon Stein's own work, a new feminism. And he called upon women to promote in thought and action this important work. And boy, do we need it today. After all, modern and postmodern feminist ideology has reached its self-destroying zenith in the erasure of women in gender ideology and the putative right to intentionally end the life of one's developing unborn child. As I argue in The Rights of Women, by abandoning early feminism's defense of vulnerable human, unborn human beings, and by elevating the status-bearing goods of the market over the civilizationally essential goods of the home, modern feminism lionized market equality over early feminism's insistence on moral equality. And in doing so, it has recklessly undermined the true interests of women and the very purpose of rights. So to my mind, to effectively fight the cultural and legal disintegration wrought by this ideological feminism of the 20th century, we need a new feminism for the 21st, a movement that first advocates for women as women, and second, understands that rights are intrinsically linked with responsibilities, just as the original 19th century movement for women's rights did. If ever there was a time to build a kind of new women's movement, a phoenix rising from the ashes of modern feminism's internal combustion, that time is now. And John Paul II was prescient in this regard. So why then the whiplash I mentioned at the outset? Well, just as some prominent progressive feminists are finally coming to see the fallout of the sexual revolution and its particular harms to women and children, but men too. Think Louise Perry's highly acclaimed The Case Against the Sexual Revolution as the most obvious exemplar, but there are others we might mention. And just as the deep truths of theology of the body have been primed to speak to our porn-addled, sexually sick world, and just as some of the new atheists, can you believe this? Some of the new atheists and the likes of Jordan Peterson are taking a fresh look at Christian truths. That is just as all this good is happening right now. Some quarters of the church are now undermining John Paul II's magisterial teachings, are claiming his teachings on women are not authentically Catholic. Now, I'm not talking about progressive Catholics who dissent from church teaching on sex and marriage. They have long claimed, and this was true when I was in graduate school, that there's no difference between contraception and NFP, for instance. No, now it's those claiming to defend authentic Catholicism from the right, often some making that very same claim that there's no difference between contraception and NFP, or arguing that there can be no such thing as Christian feminism, or even that John Paul II's teachings on, say, the mutual submission of spouses in marriage were just the inklings of a private theologian, not the authentic development of the church's doctrine itself. Thus, the whiplash. As Catholic provocateur Matt Walsh put the growing anti-feminist view most pithily on X, Twitter, quote, "Feminism has been aggressively anti-family since its inception. There is no good feminism. It has always been destructive and poisonous. But this, I am here and very happy to report, is historically false." And because so much of this animus toward kind of feminism per se is based on false historical claims about early feminism, and because in early feminism, I, as a Catholic legal theorist, find so much to build upon, I want to turn our attention now toward these early thinkers. So as I detail in a very long commissioned essay that's forthcoming from the Heritage Foundation, the early women's movement in the United States, in speeches at national conventions and in other public writings, made strong appeals to scripture and the divinely ordained natural law, the virtues of men and of marriage. The inherent dignity of children, born and unborn, as I've mentioned, and a single standard of chaste sexual norms, which I've mentioned too, as well as the distinctive goods and shared responsibilities of motherhood and fatherhood. Even as this early movement leaned on the natural rights tradition of the American founding, it owed its chief arguments to Christianity, and it grounded its claims explicitly in the Imago Dei. They spoke in one voice about women's family and social responsibilities and the God-given natural rights that enabled their fulfillment. For such reasons, modern woman-erasing feminist ideology is not the early movement's legitimate heir. In the time I have now that remains, I want to look at the chief causes and arguments of early feminism and how they lay the historical groundwork for a new JP2-inspired feminism in the United States context. So in a moment, I'll turn to the proximate cause of this early movement in industrialization. But for a Catholic audience such as this, I want first to relate what both the early American feminists and John Paul II regarded as the ultimate reason for feminism: the fall. So in the Genesis creation accounts, we find both male and female created equally in the image of God, equal in his image, but sexually dimorphic. And in this definitional distinctiveness, we see the reproductive complementarity of male and female bodies that makes possible human generation, of course. But we also can immediately appreciate a fundamental asymmetry, one that I alluded to earlier. Women reproduce inside themselves and are physically weaker and more vulnerable than the men who reproduce outside of themselves and are physically stronger, and we now know, less adverse to risk. Sexual asymmetry is a beautiful gift of creation, the source of original harmony and fruitfulness, of spousal self-gift, as John Paul II taught. But after the fall, sexual asymmetry is also the reason for the marked danger male superior strength poses to more vulnerable women. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you, is how Genesis describes the fated curse, is how God describes the fated curse upon women. The libido dominandi that would deform the relationship between the sexes throughout human history. Now, of course, Christ's redemption and Mary's enabling fiat are the very wellspring of marital chastity and fruitful harmony that describe holy and happy couples in every era. But in this fallen world, and in our time rapidly secularizing world, we also need feminism, which we can define quite basically as social, legal, and political attention to the distinctive interests of women on account of their common humanity and greater vulnerability. So first then, to ensure that vulnerable women are legally protected from vicious men, even, or perhaps especially, when those men are their husbands. But also to ensure that women, equally human and thereby rational creatures made in God's image, are in every historic era provided the kinds of education and encouraged in the kinds of vocation that are worthy of both their high dignity and their individual gifts, just the same as men. For those who know Edith Stein's work, consider her warning about, quote, confining a woman to a sphere too narrow for her talents. This is indeed very close to the argument that Sarah Grimke made. This is this noted abolitionist, a really important figure in the early women's rights movement, that she made in her Letters on the Equality of the Sexes in 1838, which was second only to Wollstonecraft's Rights of Women in its influence over the early women's movement in our country. But before getting any deeper into those texts where she exegetes from the original Hebrew Genesis, that's Grimke, I'm going to turn to that soon, but I want to consider why a movement on behalf of women arose when it did, because after all, devout Catholic Christine de Pizan made very similar arguments for women's equal status as rational creatures created in God's image in the early 15th century, as did High Church Anglican Mary Estelle in the late 17th. Indeed, in her beautiful book of The City of Ladies, which you should all read, Pazan points to the Imago Dei and Mary's Fiat too as the source of women's equal dignity against the centuries-long influence of Aristotle's account of the female as a deformed male, as well as other derogatory views of women. Quote, this is Pazan, how can any mouth dare to slander the vessel which bears such a noble imprint, she writes. Further, she articulates, the shared call to cultivate all the virtues, all the human virtues we see throughout these early feminist texts, which is distinctive from Aristotle and Rousseau, as we'll see. Quote, the man or woman in whom resides the greater virtue is the higher. Neither loftiness nor the lowliness of a person lies in the body according to sex, but in the perfection of conduct and virtues. But Pazan, as beautiful as that book is, did not influence a whole movement of women the way that Wollstonecraft and Grimke did. No, that would take the major economic and cultural shift of the Industrial Revolution and liberalism writ large. Indeed, as I have written about extensively, the 19th century women's movement rose in direct response to industrialization. As factories drew men and then poorer women out of family farms and shops to earn wages. As remunerative paying work left the home and with it, men too, wage-earning husbands became newly dependent upon industrial capitalists, making home-making women dependent upon the wages of their husbands in a way that they never had been before. After all, the existential interdependency and common interests of husband and wife as they labored together in the productive agrarian household for centuries of human history had begun to fray in this new economy. Even as much traditional household work began to be displaced by these same technological developments. Just think of the industrial loom. Consider that in 1810, 90% of textile production was done in households, often by women on their looms with children playing underfoot. More still, under the then extant legal doctrine of coverture, a married woman lost the right she had as a femme sole or single woman to transfer property or execute contracts and was expected through coverture by law to rely upon her husband's assumed beneficence. Already risky for the wife of a vicious husband, you can imagine, coverture was particularly ill-suited to the new economy. In cases of neglect, abandonment, or abuse, mothers had to find the means to fully provide for themselves and their children, but coverture also assumed the children's were their father's, and wife's earnings and any family property she brought into the marriage belonged solely to her husband, now as a liberal individual. And because even single women lacked the educational, economic, and legal means to independently earn a living for themselves in the new economy, they were often thrust into marriages and the full dependency that coverture marriage entailed out of sheer economic need. Meanwhile, to shore up a vision of the home as a loving haven from the dog-eat-dog industrializing world, women were increasingly depicted culturally and by means of their Rousseauian education, which I'll talk about later, as fragile and weak. A recurring trope in Western thought that has never quite described actual women and their significant contribution to the productive household in every age. The shared household labors and common ownership of medieval women and men, or even the resourceful wife in Proverbs 31, should help to relativize the idea of a divinely ordained breadwinner-caregiver split, even if that's still a really advantageous way for many families to divide their labors in our post-industrial setting today. So on the heels of the Second Great Awakening in the early 19th century, middle-class Christian women began to speak out, not only against the ongoing moral outrage of slavery, but also in regard to the social upheaval and economic precarity industrialization had inflicted upon women and children on the margins of society. They began to organize themselves and speak out publicly against slavery, child labor, illiteracy, domestic abuse, male intemperance in alcohol, marital rape, coveture marriage, and the legal and societal factors, for instance, the sexual double standard, that contributed to growing rates of prostitution, infanticide, and abortion. But as they did so, some Christians began to denounce the public advocacy of female abolitionists like Sarah Grimke as unnatural and unwomanly. Such denunciations are actually why Grimke wrote her letters on the equality of the sexes in the first place. So I want to turn now to her letters, a key document of the early of the antebellum feminist movement, which we really never hear because it's been entirely memory-holed. And during the Q&A, I'm happy to talk about why I think that that's happened. In the letters, Grimke translates Genesis from the original Hebrew, showing how God made woman a suitable companion to man, a helpmate, quote, in all respects his equal, one who is like himself, gifted with intellect and endowed with immortality, a moral and responsible being. Further, she says, quote, dominion was given to both over every other creature, but not over each other. Grimke then argues that perverted translations of the curse to women after the fall in Genesis had falsely converted a prediction to Eve into a command to Adam. These translations long condemned women to an undignified, the translations of women will, you know, you'll be ruled by your husband, etc. These translations long condemned women to an undignified rule at the hands of dominating men, not a reciprocal companionship of equals. The lesson Grimke draws from her translations of Genesis is that just as the man is individually responsible to God for his talents, so too is the woman. Christ alone is her master, she writes, and quote, the glory of God is the end of her creation. But lack of proper education had kept woman absolutely dependent, answerable not primarily to God, but to man. Edith Stein would put the same point a century later. It is, quote, sinful theft toward God to give oneself completely to another other than God. Grimke's interpretation of Genesis would be echoed throughout the antebellum movement and beyond. Women speaking at or writing in the first national conventions in the early 1850s likewise grounded women's equal status in the Imago Dei, declaring that man and woman were made for equal companionship and that, quote, every mature soul is responsible directly to God. They also followed Grimke's view of the fall. Paulina Davis, who served as the president of the first couple national conventions and collected convention speeches into the aptly named publication, Woman's Rights, Commensurate with Her Capacities and Obligations, stated that the fall had, quote, inverted the order of human things. Women became the victim of suffering and bondage. Man became her master and swallowed up her existence into his, which is how coverture is often understood. Calling upon the, quote, Messiah, she's saying, the Prince of Peace, who took the form of a servant, Davis bemoaned how, quote, power, which is properly only the servant of goodness, is everywhere its master. She continued, quote, womanhood, which is chosen to characterize the church made perfect as the bride of the Lamb, follows this rule, is everywhere in a state of degradation, corresponding inversely to the glory which is yet to be revealed in her, end quote. Echoing Grimke's argument that Genesis 3 included a descriptive prophecy addressed to woman and not a command to man, Antoinette Blackwell turned to the interpretation of various texts in the New Testament. Blackwell argued that, quote, The submission enjoined upon the wife in the New Testament is not the unrighteous rule predicted in the Old. She said that it was a Christian submission. Quote, do also from man toward man and from man toward woman, quoting several scriptural passages, including Ephesians 5:21, ye all of you be subject to one another, just so happens to be the first reading in today's Mass. With regard to the scriptural injunction that in marriage, man is the head of the woman, Antoinette Blackwell responds, quote, true, but only in the sense in which Christ is represented as head of his body, the church. The mystical head and body, or Christ and his church, symbolizes oneness, union. Christ so loved the church, he gave himself up for it. She continues, so ought men to love their wives. Then the rule of domination, which grew out of sin, she says, will cease with the sin. On the eve of the first National Women's Rights Convention, one of the most beloved leaders who took part in many of the was very much a part of those early conventions, she wrote a speech which responded to the prevalent challenge that women's public advocacy was making them unwomanly and taking them out of their, quote, their appropriate sphere. In this 1849 speech, Lucretia Mott explicitly defends both sexual difference and woman's responsibility to develop her own capacities. She writes, quote, we would admit all the difference that our great and beneficent Creator has made in relation of man and woman. Nor do we seek to disturb this relation, but we deny that the present position of woman is her true sphere of usefulness. Indeed, Mott happily points to woman's difference from man in, quote, nature, configuration, and physical strength, concluding, we are satisfied with nature. But she argues, women like men have a duty to develop their God-given powers and human capacities for the good. Mott was worried, as so many female writers before and after her, as we're going to see in this kind of next section of the talk, that women's want of liberal education and mature responsibilities were leading some to a, quote, degenerate into a kind of effeminacy, a sentimentality, quote, in which she is satisfied to be the mere plaything or toy of society, content with her outward adornings and the tone of flattery, end quote. In this, she echoes Wollstonecraft quite closely. But as we will see, both precede Edith Stein in their shared concern over female degeneracy. To become a true woman, Mott argues, she must, quote, understand her duties, physical, intellectual, and moral, and cultivate her powers as a moral and responsible being. Likewise, Paulina Davis's speech on the education of females at that first national convention decried the widespread valorization of a certain kind of female effeminacy that masqueraded as woman's nature, per se. Again, she echoes Wollstonecraft and prefigures Edith Stein. Cultivated, Davis argues, for the delights of her affectional nature, the heart is disproportionately developed, and she is made a creature of pure feeling and passionate impulse. She continues, intellectual culture of any kind that might abate or balance feeling is held unwomanly, and the sex is enslaved by the disproportionate activity of its own distinguishing traits. The overstrength of her heart, Davis concludes, is exaggerated by the weakness of her head. Listen now to Stein in her essays on woman. Quote, the one-sidedness to which by nature the woman inclines is particularly dangerous. Unilateral emotional development. She goes on, where discipline of mind and will are lacking, emotional life becomes a compulsion without secure direction, end quote. This is why Stein, like Pazan, Estelle, Wollstonecraft, Grimke, and all these early feminists argued that because women were human, they must cultivate all of the virtues, not just those traditionally considered feminine. Indeed, unilateral emotional development is the chief target of Wollstonecraft's Rights of Woman as well. It is why she argues early on in the text that, quote, the mother who wishes to give true dignity of character to her daughter must proceed on a plan diametrically opposed to that which Rousseau has recommended. Rousseau's educational plan for women laid out in his Emile had, with other similar educational treaties at that time, defined women's education for the sake not of women's own development, but for the sake of men. Rousseau wished to see women lean into what these early feminists and Stein too considered female or feminine degeneracies, sentimentality, sensuality, and the slavish desire to please men. Rousseau seemed to think that men will only serve the family as good providers and defenders, as he believed they should be, if they perceive women to be comparatively weak and entirely dependent upon them. Men must idolize women, Rousseau thought, as a kind of foreign, mysterious species, so that then men will consecrate themselves to the family and the state's protection. I wonder if this sounds familiar to anyone. Throughout the text, Wollstonecraft points to the many risks to women who forego their own moral and intellectual development. First, a woman who is trained up from her youth to focus on her beauty and gentility to win the best husband are vulnerable to being abandoned for a younger woman as her beauty wanes, or being left a widow with no substantial moral, and you can imagine, economic resources to depend upon because she was so focused on becoming pleasing. Or taught to reign by her beauty and charm, she may also be tempted by the attention she receives from other men who aren't her husband. The Rousseauian path that leads, according to Wollstonecraft, leads women to become either the abject slaves of men or capacious tyrants over them, incapable of being what she and really the early feminists, all of them, hoped for them. Quote, this is Wollstonecraft, more observant daughters, more affectionate sisters, more faithful wives, and more reasonable mothers. But it is only in placing oneself in right relationship with God, Wollstonecraft thought, and understanding kind of their own part in the whole, will women, Wollstonecraft believed, live according to their own high dignity and come to understand how important their work was as daughters, sisters, friends, wives, and mothers. They will be strong, faithful, and benevolent women, fixated not on appearances and consumed with how to please, but rather preparing themselves and their children for eternity. We can say that Wollstonecraft wants women to resist what Stein calls the specific degeneracy of woman, which Stein and Mott and Davis too, as we heard, similarly describe as servile dependence on men or caring inordinately about what others think, leading to what Stein calls a predominantly sensual animal existence. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. This feminine degeneracy or servile dependence is not good for women and their capacity to virtuously carry out their duties. But even before that, this degeneracy is also particularly dangerous to women in light of what Stein and the early women's advocates too regard as the specific degeneracy of man. This is Stein saying, brutal despotism over other creatures, especially women. The kind of pagan rule, or what we heard Blackwell call the unrighteous rule predicted in the Old Testament, the rule that grew out of sin. The particular risk for women, according to Stein, is that, quote, instead of spiritualizing the body, the soul is controlled by it, and the body loses accordingly its character as a human body. Wollstonecraft sings the same tune, quote, taught from infancy that beauty is woman's scepter, the mind shapes itself to the body and seeks only to adorn its prison. So whereas Rousseau wished for women to lean into and make use of their kind of feminine charms, both Wollstonecraft and Stein and the rest want by education and in Stein's word, objective work to protect women from the characteristic vices to which they are tempted so that they may become fully human. As Stein put it, quote, because objective work which we view as a remedy for the faults of feminine singularity, is something to which the average man is naturally inclined. It can thus be said as well that an allowance of masculine nature is the antidote for the hyper feminine nature. And we can see this kind of a parallel antidote for the workaholism and objectification to which men are tempted. The remedy is for men to make an allowance for that to which the average woman is naturally inclined, attending to the cares and needs of persons. Indeed, in the family, to give their very lives up for their wives and children. In a word, each sex can be liberated from its own degenerate tendencies by cultivating in themselves all of the virtues, especially those that are most naturally acquired by the opposite sex. And indeed, the early women's rights advocates all called upon women to resist their respective era's depiction of women as fragile and weak. And so they fought for women to be liberally and morally educated so they could fulfill their human capacities and their particular duties excellently. After all, to undertake responsibly the demands of motherhood, in particular, a privilege that made them, in the words of one advocate, second only to God, women needed to be intellectually, morally, and physically strong for their own sakes, their husbands, their children's, and really the whole society. A regard for mutual dependence, reciprocal responsibilities in marriage, and a common familial interest of men and women runs through the early women's rights conventions. This is true even as men who behave as tyrants and coveter marriage, which might enable such tyranny, are strongly condemned. In sum, just as these women bemoan a degeneracy of femininity, the slavish dependency, as distinctive from true, mature, strong, responsible womanhood, they also bemoan faux or tyrannical masculinity as distinctive from true, mature, responsible manhood. Neither degeneracy is from God. Both are products of the fall. Both are to be resisted and transformed to uphold the equal dignity of all. In addition to the primary goal, then, of a co-equal liberal education to facilitate their full development as women, the equal movement sought property and contract rights to justly recognize and remunerate their contributions inside and outside the household, custody rights so they wouldn't be forced to abandon their children to escape domestic abuse, rights of access to trades and professions so they could continue to make economic contributions to the household in the new industrial economy and not be forced into an ill-sorted suited marriage or prostitution just to survive, the right to voluntary motherhood, to wit, the right to decline unwanted sex against the legally sanctioned prerogative of their husbands, and the right to not be taxed or otherwise governed without political representation, and as time wore on, just workplace laws and protections. As I conclude then now, let me call attention to how distinctive their account of rights was from today's abortion-obsessed brand. In the modern view, rights are a kind of license for personal and sexual autonomy, the abstract freedom to determine a future unhindered by, a freedom from unchosen moral and bodily constraints. In sharp contrast, rights for the antebellum movement, or as at the American founding, were always correlated with concrete responsibilities, freedom for doing what one ought. Indeed, in some cases, rights and responsibilities read not as opposites as we too often think of them today, but rather as synonyms. Early women's rights advocate Lucy Stone makes this clear as she describes the movement in 1892. Quote, "We are all getting to be women's rights advocates, or rather investigators of women's duties." As the antebellum movement generally appreciated, explicitly building upon Mary Wollstonecraft's 1792 treatise, freedom from arbitrary rule is freedom for excellence, and in particular, the excellence of carrying out one's concrete duties to God, family, and community virtuously. Theirs was a natural law account of women's rights. But this account of rights is no longer known to us. Born of a Hobbesian and really early modern rejection of the Christian understanding of nature, sin and grace, vice and virtue, and so also a distorted view of rule, obedience, and submission, law is no longer understood as Thomas Aquinas taught. command of reason, promulgated for the common good by he who has care of the community. Now law and rule is power all the way down. And this greatly impacts how too many, even I think in the church today, think about the rights and duties of women and men. But this is not Christianity. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.